Part 2. The Rise. Entia non sunt multiplicanda praeter necessitatum. Entities must not be multiplied unnecessarily. Given two theories, all else equal, the simpler is preferred. The law of ontological parsimony, also known as Occam's razor, for philosopher-theologian William of Occam, circa 1288 to 1348. Chapter 6. Germination. Since 1938, there have come to our attention a number of children whose condition differs so markedly and uniquely from anything reported so far that each case merits, and I hope will eventually receive, a detailed consideration of its fascinating peculiarities. Leo Kanner, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact, April 1943. In 1943, Leo Kanner profiled 11 anonymous children in his study that introduced autism to the world, assigning each child a case number and a first name and last initial. Case 1. Donald T. Case 2. Frederick W. And so on. In a contribution to the history of autism that is markedly different from anything reported so far, we have identified 7 of those 11 cases by matching details described in the paper with publicly available information. Some names yielded to simple internet queries. Others required months of trial and error and more than a little luck. We have so far been unable to find the remaining 4. In identifying the children, all born in the 1930s, we also came across a critical shared clue: exposure to the ethyl mercury compounds introduced during that decade, compounds that had an uncanny proximity of time and place in the backgrounds of most of the families. For example, Frederick Wellman's experiments within the fungicide branch of Morris Karish's Ethyl Mercury Innovations is especially well documented. To find this father of Kanner's Case 2 working with the new ethyl mercury fungicides at exactly the same time his son was born ought to give any fair-minded observer pause. Were that the only association, it would be quite startling. But there is more. In another case, one mother's work as a public health pediatrician frequently brought her into contact with the ethyl mercury-containing diphtheria vaccine, pointing to the presence of a pharmaceutical vector in the same small group of children. Other families' backgrounds signal the same two connections, less directly. Yet put together, they suggest this is no coincidence. As we have throughout the book, we do not claim proof, but offer patterns of evidence, patterns that place ethyl mercury and vaccination in close proximity to the index cases of autism. They make it more difficult to dismiss the theory that autism is an environmental illness triggered by a toxic insult in vulnerable children. And they strengthen the argument that the age of autism began as another sad chapter in the long, hidden history of mercury poisoning. Before the deluge. In the 1930s and 1940s, Johns Hopkins Hospital was a magnet for teaching, research, and cutting-edge treatment, rivaled by few big city hospitals. Aerial shots from the period show a complex stretching for many city blocks around the original, ornate, red brick building. Even today, surrounded by modern glass and chrome buildings, connected with elevated walkways and parking garages, the domed structure in downtown Baltimore resembles a beacon, like the Salpêtrière in Paris, a secular Lourdes, dedicated to healing, to medical miracles, offering a last hope for the desperate. People from around the country came to take advantage of its specialties, among them the syphilis treatment headed by the nation's acknowledged expert, Dr. Joseph Earl Moore, pioneering surgery for blue babies with congenital heart defects that saved tens of thousands, and the psychiatric service launched by the legendary Adolf Meyer. Meyer was at the front lines of American psychiatry in the 20th century, and he was in the front row when Freud came to America for the first and only time in 1909 and delivered the lectures at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, that launched the Freudian frenzy in the United States. Meyer, however, was no Freudian. He was an empiricist with an eclectic approach he called psychobiology, which considered both biology and family dynamics as causal. He pioneered the use of detailed case reports in assessing psychiatric patients. One of his students, Wendell Munsey, wrote, "For almost half a century, American psychiatry has been enriched by the work of Adolf Meyer." Psychobiology, according to Munsey in his book, Psychobiology and Psychiatry, is the study of those functions distinctively human, the things man is best known for, the mentally integrated performances. The study demands knowledge of the physical sciences and of anatomy and physiology, but those in no wise, no way, explain the phenomena under observation. Their explanation must be in terms appropriate to the complexity of their level of integration, biological, but of a type operating with more or less consciousness, a hanging together in a flow with symbolization. This description, with its mind-body integration and almost Eastern emphasis on consciousness as the mechanism through which human life is mediated, stands up quite well today, much better than classical Freudianism, as we outlined in Chapter 2. Adolf Meyer was the doctor to whom Leo Kanner wrote in 1928 from his position at the Yankton State Hospital, responding to the announcement of a psychiatric fellowship at Hopkins. Meyer interviewed Kanner at a conference both attended in Minnesota and took note of the 30-year-old's initiative, his papers on the rare incidence of general paralysis of the insane in Native Americans, as well as his original and comprehensive book, Folklore of the Teeth, published the year before. But Meyer wondered whether Kanner was too research-oriented for the post, and although he responded with interest, he did not explicitly offer it to him. Kanner, who had already navigated the considerably greater leap from Berlin to Yankton, seized the moment and simply announced when he would arrive at Hopkins. Once there, he never left. The fellowship turned into a faculty post, and Kanner rose quickly. In 1930, Meyer and a famed Hopkins pediatrics professor, Edwards A. Park, put him in charge of the first children's psychiatric service within a pediatric department in the United States. By 1935, Kanner had published his groundbreaking textbook, Child Psychiatry, a comprehensive diagnostic handbook for children's disorders. For the first time, every known childhood disorder was described in rich detail. Kanner had observed most of them firsthand among the many hundreds of children referred to Hopkins in his first years there, and his voracious reading and scholarly bent allowed him to develop a sweeping command of the field. The textbook's 527 pages, with prefaces by Meyer and Park, apply the psychobiological approach to childhood disorders and catalog minor psychoses, including what was still known as hysteria. Major psychoses like schizophrenia, organic disorders such as juvenile paresis, the tragic occurrence of general paralysis of the insane in children with congenital syphilis, and even mongolism. The present volume, Kanner wrote, which is the first textbook of child psychiatry in the English language, is offered as an attempt to cover the entire field of children's personality disorders on a broad, objective, unbiased, practical basis. It has grown out of everyday contact with pediatricians, consultation work in a large pediatric clinic and dispensary, collaboration with private practitioners and with the various child-caring agencies of the community, schools, orphanages, hospitals, welfare groups, courts, custodial and correctional institutions, and teaching activities at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Nothing remotely resembling autism appears in this attempt to cover the entire field of children's personality disorders, So when Kanner described the autism cases he would soon encounter as different from anything ever reported, he deserves to be taken seriously. But it wasn't just the lack of earlier cases that we find so persuasive as evidence of an environmental risk for autism. It is the kind of families that started showing up in Leo Kanner's office. Kanner's discovery. The well baby visit to the doctor for a checkup and vaccinations is the foundation of modern pediatric practice. Yet the concept is a relatively recent innovation. A pioneering program in the 1930s at the Harvard School of Public Health helped create the model. This center was planned mainly to provide facilities for research upon well children equivalent to those of other departments concerned with the study of sick children, states a 1939 report by Harvard's Experimental Center for Research in Child Health and Development. The center was also intended to afford an opportunity for students to become familiar with normal child development and preventive pediatrics. The opportunity included x-rays, dental observations, a detailed health history, dietary records, and advice. Even observations regarding the child's daily routine, from rest to exercise. They also deal with the types of games indulged in and the mechanical toys available. They record progress toward walking and other accomplishments, evidence of emotional reactions to play, and evidence of fatigue. Vaccines were a key part of the protocol. At 9 months, the visits involved routine examinations, routine interviews with mother, and diphtheria toxoid inoculation. At 12 months, a Schick test to determine whether the diphtheria shot had taken effect, and vaccination. By the late 1930s, the ethyl mercury preservative called thimerosal had been widely adopted as part of mass vaccination with diphtheria toxoid. Anyone receiving a diphtheria shot would have received an exposure to ethyl mercury along with it. It is unclear whether the doctors and nurses who ran the program were also vaccinated, but it seems logical given the availability of the shots and the risk of infection that goes with dealing with susceptible children on a daily basis. 7 pediatricians were part of the project. One of them, Elizabeth Peabody Trivett, was on a fellowship at Harvard after graduating from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She had 3 children in quick succession during this period. By the time the fellowship ended, so had her marriage to Lawrence Trivett, a neuropsychiatrist she met and married in 1931, when both were working on their medical degrees at Hopkins. Lawrence Trivett, board-certified in both neurology and psychiatry, had co-authored a 1945 paper on neurosyphilis, Penicillin Treatment of Neurosyphilis, which made clear that treatment of advanced forms like general paralysis of the insane was part of his practice and training. After the divorce, Elizabeth moved back to Maryland with her children, working a couple of years at Hopkins before settling in Annapolis, probably because of its proximity to her medical roots, and perhaps since a children's health program similar to the one she helped develop at Harvard was just getting underway there. Dr. Peabody, she sometimes used her maiden name professionally, continued to promote well-baby care for infants and children to stave off deadly illnesses. In the same way Frederick Wellman approached plant pathology as a weapon against famine, starvation, and death, it was her calling. Dr. Elizabeth Peabody, well-known pediatrician in Annapolis, gave a timely talk yesterday at the monthly Parent Teachers Association meeting of the Annapolis Grammar School, held at the school. The Annapolis Capitol reported in 1947. She spoke upon communicable diseases and outlined their prevention or control, a subject of vital interest to most parents. "Too many parents," said Dr. Peabody, "have the proper shots given, and then relax, forgetting that booster shots are needed and that immunization does wear off." Speaking specifically of some of the most prevalent ailments, she stated that a child cannot be vaccinated against smallpox too often, and it should be done for the first time when a baby is between 3 months and 1 year of age. In the case of diphtheria, booster shots are extremely important. Meanwhile, children's welfare took on a poignant personal dimension for Elizabeth Peabody. Her son John, born in 1937 while she was part of Harvard's Well Baby Project, was never well, developmentally speaking. At first, he appeared mentally retarded. She considered him always slow and quiet. There was concern that he might be deaf because he did not register any change of expression when spoken to or when in the presence of other people. Also, he made no attempt to speak or to form words. John was the youngest of the three children. There were serious concerns as well with the oldest, a girl. She danced in circles, made strange noises, would say you when she meant I, and ignored other people completely. But she seemed to blossom out after the divorce, her mother said. John did not. His mother took him to see Leo Kanner in February 1941, and under the pseudonym Herbert B., he became Case 7 in Kanner's landmark series. But the case that first alerted Kanner to the new syndrome he came to call autism was not a child from Maryland or a professional medical colleague. Instead, he was the son of a lawyer and a former schoolteacher who lived in the small lumber town of Forest, Mississippi. Kanner called him Case 1, Donald T. Donald T.'s full name was Donald Gray Triplett. His father was O.B. Triplett, Jr., known by his middle name, Beeman. He was an attorney, successful, meticulous, hard-working, who had earned his law degree with honors from Yale a decade earlier. If anything, he might have been excessively conscientious. Two breakdowns by age 35 were attributed to the strain of work. He also had asthma. The Triplets were an old, affluent, and respected Forrest family. Beeman's father was a lawyer, too, a pillar of Forrest. He had served as mayor, as a school and church trustee, and as chancery clerk. Donald's mother, Mary McCravey Triplett, was a former schoolteacher with an impressive pedigree of her own. A graduate of Belhaven College in Jackson, and daughter of the founder of the Bank of Forrest, the most imposing building in town. Beeman Triplett and Mary McCravey wed on June 19, 1930. Their circumstances were more fortunate than most in that first full Depression year, and they acquired 7 acres on the edge of town where they built an unpretentious but comfortable wood house for their anticipated family, with a large screened porch and tall windows to look out on the flowers and the trees and the children who would play on the broad lawn. Donald was born September 8, 1933, full term, near 7 pounds, the first child of this first family of Forrest. There were difficulties from the start. Eating has always been a problem with him, his father wrote. He has never shown a normal appetite. Seeing children eating candy and ice cream has never been a temptation to him. At age 4, he weighed no more than 30 pounds, a third underweight. That was the least of it. Donald displayed a combination of startling gifts and strange behaviors, fascinating peculiarities, one might say. First, the gifts. He could hum and sing many tunes accurately. By age 1, he possessed, in fact, the rare endowment of perfect pitch. He had an unusual memory for faces and names, knew the names of a great number of houses in Forrest. He knew the 23rd Psalm and the 25 questions and answers of the Presbyterian Catechism. He knew the presidents from their pictures, as well as most of the pictures of his ancestors and kinfolk on both sides of the house. He could recite the alphabet backward and forward and count to 100. When it came to relating to his parents or anyone else, though, Donald was markedly and uniquely different because of his indifference. He appeared to inhabit a universe of one. He was happiest when left alone, seldom went to his mother, failed to notice his father's comings and goings or anyone else's, even ignored Santa Claus. He seems to be self-satisfied, his father wrote. He seems almost to draw into his shell and live within himself. What did interest him, starting in his second year, was spinning blocks and pans and other round objects. His use of language was downright bizarre. He treated words as some kind of magic spell, as if summoning them in the right order could ward off unseen demons. If he wanted to get down from the crib after his nap, he would instruct his mother, whom he called Boo. Boo say, "Don, do you want to get down?" After she complied, he would tell her, "Now say, all right." He reversed pronouns as if he had no sense of self and other. When he stumbled but recovered, he said, "You did not fall down." Words took on idiosyncratic meanings that were fixed in place like quick-drying cement. Donald named each of his watercolor bottles for one of the Dion quintuplets, who were then a media sensation, Annette for blue, Cecile for red, and so on. The word yes meant only one thing. He wanted his father to put him on his shoulders. This derived from Beeman's use of the activity to teach Donald yes and no, but once yes came to stand for that, it stood for nothing else. When he was asked to subtract 4 from 10, he answered, "I'll draw a hexagram," a six-sided object that expressed the right answer in a language all his own. His parents, naturally, were baffled and alarmed. They marshaled their considerable resources to try to help their firstborn. One summer they brought home from the local orphanage a boy Donald's age to try to draw him out. But Donald has never asked him a question, nor answered a question, nor romped with him in play. They bought him a slide in the summer of 1937, hoping it might encourage playful interaction with other children, but he would only use it when no one else was around. That August they placed him in a tuberculosis sanitarium to see if a change of environment would help. It did not. He gained weight, but developed a new habit of repeatedly shaking his head from side to side. The next year, their family doctor, stymied by this utterly typical-looking but completely unreachable child, suggested a consultation with the leading child psychiatrist in the United States. So in October 1938, when Donald was 5 years old, the triplets set out from Forest by train to meet Leo Kanner. They traveled east across the pine forests of southern Mississippi, past the sawmills that hugged the tracks. The mills were mostly silent now, felled by the deepening depression. The big lumber companies, Eastman Gardner, Bienville Marathon, were in financial distress. In their place, the New Deal was creating the Bienville National Forest, a round forest in Scott County, putting thousands of unemployed young men to work in the Civilian Conservation Corps, planting millions of seedlings. Before Donald's arrival in Baltimore, Beeman Triplett sent Hopkins a 33-page letter describing his son's behavior and background. But actually meeting Donald must have been electrifying for someone of Kanner's observational powers and professional ambition. Years later, he described this moment. "In 1938, 5-year-old Donald T., brought to my clinic from Forest, Mississippi, made me aware of a behavior pattern not known to me or anyone else theretofore. When I saw a few more children presenting similar characteristics, I reported in 1943 11 cases in some detail in a now-extinct journal, The Nervous Child." This is the article so frequently cited ever since. No doubt influenced by Adolf Meyer's emphasis on detailed case histories, Kanner's accounts of those 11 original autistic children are as complete and compelling as any that have followed in the intervening decades. After a one-paragraph introduction, "Since 1938, there have come to our attention a number of children," he goes straight to Case 1, Donald T., who takes up 5 pages of observation and background. After that, the order in which the children appear in Autistic Disturbances seems idiosyncratic, following neither birth order nor the sequence in which they arrived. In fact, Donald was not the first case seen at Hopkins. In 1935, a 3-and-a-half-year-old boy named David Speck was brought for evaluation by his mother, Miriam, a psychologist. She had separated from her husband, John, a chemist and attorney in the U.S. Patent Office in Washington, shortly after David's birth, and moved back in with her parents in Baltimore in the summer of 1932. David's unusual behavior was duly noted in his Hopkins medical file. His mother reported, "Language developed slowly. He seemed to have no interest in it. He seldom tells experience. He still confuses pronouns. Since he talked, there has been a tendency to repeat over and over one word or statement. He is upset when the sun sets. He is upset because the moon does not always appear in the sky at night. He prefers to play alone. He will get down from a piece of apparatus as soon as another child approaches." In Autistic Disturbances, Kanner made note of David Speck's 1935 visit to Hopkins. He calls him Case 8, Alfred L. So it is not clear why he would assert in later years that Donald, not David, was the very first, or sentinel, case, an important position in medical literature. Perhaps Kanner himself did not evaluate David on that initial visit in 1935. But someone apparently connected the dots. In August 1938, about the time Beeman Triplett's letter describing Donald arrived, the clinic asked David's mother for a follow-up report. They apparently were preparing for their exotic visitor from Forest. Today, Baltimore is just a plane ride away from almost anywhere in the world. But the effort and outreach it took to bring Donald from small-town Mississippi to the temple that Kanner once wryly called the Great Hopkins should not be overlooked. It's nothing short of remarkable. In order of arrival at Hopkins, then, David Speck in 1935 came first, followed by Donald Triplett in 1938. In 1939 came Elaine C., whom Kanner described as a daughter of a father who had studied at the Sorbonne and a magazine editor mother. And in 1940, John F., whom we have identified as Lee Rosenberg, son of a Maryland psychiatrist. Then, in close succession during an 18-month period between 1941 and 1942, came seven more. Herbert B., John Trevitt, son of pediatrics pioneer Elizabeth Peabody Trevitt. Richard M., son of William Dykstra Miller, a forestry professor in North Carolina. Paul G., Barbara K., real name Bridget Munsey, daughter of Wendell Munsey, the colleague of Kanner and Meyer at Hopkins, who wrote Psychobiology and Psychiatry. Frederick W., Frederick C. Wellman III, whose story we told in Chapter 5. And the eldest child, Virginia S. The last child seen was Charles N. in February 1943. So, 11 children, all born in the 1930s, arriving within 8 years of each other. Kanner quickly realized he was witnessing what any medical researcher hopes to encounter once in a lifetime, a new illness or clinical entity, in this case, a distinctive developmental disorder. Fortunately, the opportunity to publish this discovery was close at hand. He had been invited to guest edit an issue of the new medical journal, The Nervous Child, and he told Ernest Harms, a psychiatrist friend who was its editor, about his idea. As to the issue due early in 1943, I wonder what you would think of the general topic, affective contact of children. Kanner wrote Harms on January 19, 1942, showing that the pattern had formed in his mind at least a year and a half before publication, when he had seen 8 of the 11 cases. I might have a paper of my own on autistic disturbances of affective contact in small children. I have followed a number of children who present a very interesting, unique, and as yet unreported condition, which has both interested and fascinated me for quite some time. In fact, eventually, I plan to use the material for a monographic presentation. And so, in April 1943, Kanner announced the disorder to the world in a journal whose archaic-sounding name he perceived as a minor drawback. In later years, he seemed to relish pointing out that while his discovery of autism stood the test of time, the nervous child was long gone. As the guest editor for Volume 2, Number 2, Kanner wrote the introduction. This symposium deals with the consideration of children's abilities to form affective contact with people. This writer has encountered a number of children whose behavior, from earliest infancy, raises the question of the existence of an innate inability to form affective contact with people in the ordinary way to which the human species is biologically disposed. But what was on Kanner's mind as he assembled these cases into a series? Obviously, he wanted to create a clear and compelling narrative arc in which the children's behaviors emerged. So it made eminent sense to start with Donald T., the first case, at least in his own process of discovery, and the one whose savant qualities made him the most colorful. But we think the sequence of the 11 cases also points, perhaps inadvertently, to something else. These cases are, we believe, in two distinct but connected clusters. Three cases have links to agriculture or forestry: Donald T., Frederick W., and Richard M., cases 1, 2, and 3. And in five of them, the parents came from backgrounds in medicine, psychology, or psychiatry. Barbara K., Virginia S., Alfred L., Herbert B., and John F., cases 5, 6, 7, 8, and 10. Another child, case 4, Paul G., fits loosely with the first cluster that suggests an occupational risk. The other two children, Case 11, Elaine C., and Case 9, Charles N., appear to have big city Boston and New York backgrounds that could fit the second cluster. The Fungicide Cluster. In the 1920s, Madison, Wisconsin was the place to be for a smart, young agricultural scientist like Frederick Lovejoy Wellman. It was quickly becoming a locus for the emerging fields of plant and forest pathology. In addition to the university's pathology department, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service had created the Forest Products Laboratory, the nation's leading wood research institute, in Madison in 1910. In Chapter 5, we discussed the universe of Maurice Karrasch, his invention of an ethyl mercury fungicide, and the commercial products marketed by DuPont and Bayer. Those were launched into a world of practicing plant industry professionals, including government scientists, and moved from research chemists like Julius Stiglitz and Karrasch at the universities of Chicago and Maryland to research chemists working inside DuPont, to clusters of research plant pathologists like Wellman, to the gardeners, farmers, and foresters who actually used these fungicides in their war on plant disease. The 1930 edition of the University of Wisconsin Plant Pathology Department's alumni newsletter, Wisconsin Pathogen, traces an unusually interesting subset of these close professional connections. Due to the central role of this department, it is easy to connect the pioneers of ethyl mercury fungicides, Karrasch, Engelmann, Lindgren, with the families of two of its first victims. Our family is increasing in size with each group of graduates, and everyone who leaves our circle has an interesting story to tell, and always holds a warm place in his heart for the happenings around the laboratory. The pathogen noted that recent graduate Wellman was a pathologist for the United Fruit Company at Tela, Honduras, Central America, and that he hated the weather. Slightly older alumni were already reaching the top of the field. W.H. Tisdale, who earned his Ph.D. from Wisconsin in 1922, the year Wellman arrived, had just been named to a key post in private industry. W.H. Tisdale is chief pathologist for the recently organized Bayer Semisan Company, Inc., the pathogen reported. The new corporation has taken over the agricultural disinfectants division of the Bayer Company and the DuPont Company. Bayer Semisan is the joint venture we described earlier that marketed the organic mercury fungicide Semisan and was about to launch Saracen. Time magazine, in its inimitable style, caught up with Tisdale in April 1937. Dr. Tisdale, a big, florid Alabaman of 45, is director of DuPont's new anti-pest laboratory, which was formally opened last week in the suburbs of Wilmington, and of which the formal name is Pest Control Research Section. Grasselli Chemicals Department, E.I. DuPont, De Nemours and Co. A handful of news hawks assembled in the gleaming Nemours building, launched with Lamotte DuPont, who shook each one's hand, spent the afternoon in the Battleship Gray laboratory, wound up at the Hotel DuPont bar. On its staff are two plant pathologists, six entomologists, four chemists, some 20 assistants. With an initial investment of $100,000, the laboratory's operating cost is expected to be $125,000 a year. Object is to find new and better insecticides which DuPont can sell to farmers, nurserymen, fishermen, manufacturers, housewives. Pest control was a family business for the Tisdales. W.H. Tisdale's brother, W.B., was a plant pathologist who spent time at the University of Wisconsin, where he co-authored a paper with Frederick Wellman's mentor, J.C. Walker, on cabbage fungus, Fusarium-resistant cabbage, in November 1920. Another Wisconsin alumnus leads us directly to Case 3, not only connecting Wisconsin to another original case, but connecting the lumber preservative, lignosan, to the case as well. The pathogen noted, E.E. Hubert, Moscow, Idaho, gave us a call recently on his way back to Idaho from conference in Washington. Hubert got his Ph.D. from Wisconsin, and by 1930 was a major force in the School of Forestry at the University of Idaho in Moscow. At the time he joined the Idaho faculty, Hubert had launched a large research project on the best ways to protect jointed wood products from the fungi that caused decay and stain. The work was summarized in a 1934 special issue of the University of Idaho Bulletin. Corners were sawed off and put in glass evaporating dishes. A shallow indentation was carved out of the center in which to put the toxic experimental chemicals to see which ones prevented decay and stain. In 1932, William Dykstra Miller, a newly minted Yale School of Forestry Ph.D., arrived in Idaho and joined Hubert on the faculty of the School of Forestry as an instructor. Miller, whose undergraduate degree was from Reed College in Portland, was returning to his Northwestern roots. In November 1931, just before Miller arrived, a rot cellar was constructed for the purpose of subjecting entire window sashes and large pieces of wood and wood products to conditions which favored decay and stain. The chemical dissolves and spreads through the surrounding wood, thus protecting it against fungi by poisoning the wood which furnishes the food for the attacking organisms. This is the kind of work Frederick Wellman was engaged in on the other side of the country. His focus was on plants, not trees, and his specialty was seeds, not processed lumber. But the basic idea, identify a problem caused by fungi, and then try a series of toxic chemicals to see which ones solved the problem, was strikingly similar. So was one of the substances tested by Hubert and his colleagues. Lignosan, the ethyl mercury fungicide invented by Morris Karash, who also developed Saracen, the ethyl mercury fungicide with which Wellman experimented. Other chemicals of a toxic nature which proved effective are lignosan, an organic mercury compound, Hubert wrote. A photo of a window sash was captioned, "Contrast the clearness of the right-hand corners, which were treated with lignosan, with the stained and decay-infected left-hand corners, which were treated with pyridine." Another compound Hubert tried was called borax plus K1, described as an organic mercury compound. K1 was the same experimental compound that Ralph Lindgren first used to prevent sap stain in southern Mississippi. Hubert's project summary acknowledges, as Wellman did, the razor's edge on which this kind of research perched. The toxic chemicals must diffuse readily through the wood, and the compound should not be harmful to humans, nor cause injury to the paint coating. In a department comprised of only a half dozen faculty members, William Miller was certainly either directly involved with this project or working in close proximity to these toxic chemicals in the Forest Pathology Laboratory. 3 years later, in 1935, William Miller got a job as an associate professor at North Carolina State University, one of the country's oldest and biggest forestry schools, which had recently acquired more than 80,000 acres, called the Hoffman Forest. It would operate as an experimental commercial forest, a golden opportunity for a research-oriented academic like Miller. He and his wife, Catherine, née Ritchie, packed up and headed east. 2 years later, on November 17, 1937, they had a son who in 1943 became Case 3, Richard M., in Kanner's Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact. Richard fit the familiar pattern when he was referred to Hopkins on February 5, 1941. The child seems quite intelligent, an intern reported to Kanner, playing with the toys in his bed and being adequately curious about instruments used in the examination. He seems quite self-sufficient in his play. It is difficult to tell definitely whether he hears, but it seems that he does. He does not pay attention to conversation going on around him, and although he does make noises, he says no recognizable words. In the examination room, he paid no attention to anyone, but was attracted to a small box that he threw, as if it were a ball. His first move in entering the office, or any other room, was to turn the lights on and off. He did not communicate his wishes, but went into a rage until his mother guessed and procured what he wanted. He had no contact with people, whom he definitely regarded as an interference when they talked to him or otherwise tried to gain his attention. Richard's father spent the rest of his career as an associate professor at North Carolina State. Summers found him working with students at the research camp, deep in the Hoffman Forest. He was promoted to full professor when he retired in 1963. That same year, Frederick L. Wellman arrived at North Carolina State as a visiting professor, meaning the fathers of cases 2 and 3 crossed paths in a way that demonstrated the close connections between the worlds of plant and forest pathology and autism. Miller left nowhere near the paper trail Wellman did. The latter's archives at North Carolina State fill 16 tightly packed boxes. But Miller did write the school's official history of the Hoffman Forest and a handful of research papers. One of them, Planting Pines in Pocosins, appeared in the Journal of Forestry in 1955. Pocosins are upland bogs that make up a significant portion of the South's forest land. Miller's co-author on that paper was a colleague at the North Carolina State School of Forestry, which also had close connections to Lignosan. Tenyo Ewald Mackey, known as Waldy or Tenyo, was Hoffman Distinguished Professor of Forest Management and head of the Department of Silviculture in the School of Forestry. Earlier in his career, Mackey had worked at the Southern Forest Experiment Station in New Orleans, where Ralph Lindgren did his experiments with ethyl mercury in 1929, 1930, and 1931. One of the three lumber companies that participated in the experiment station tests from the beginning, Eastman Gardner, based in Laurel, Mississippi, owned timberlands that extended north till they virtually bumped into those of Bienville Lumber, which was headquartered in Forest, Mississippi. It seems logical that Bienville and other smaller mills in the area would have been among the early adopters of lignosan, whose use had quickly spread to more than 200 mills. Forest, of course, is where Donald Triplett's parents built their house in 1930. Their next-door neighbor, from whom they acquired the 7-acre site, worked for a lumber company, most likely Bienville. Lumber companies in those days took care of their employees and built their houses, gray for white workers, red for blacks. Despite its promising start, by 1933, lignosan was showing limitations as a treatment for pine lumber. With lignosan failing frequently, in contrast to more favorable results in former years. This is attributed to the tendency of this material to volatilize slowly and leave the lumber unprotected in cases where seasoning is prolonged. The ethyl mercury was evaporating, albeit slowly, out of the wood, leaving it less protected from blue stain. From the forest pathologist's perspective, that was an efficacy problem. But for a pregnant woman or an infant, in an enclosed space like a house, the exposure to ethyl mercury would be a safety concern of the first magnitude. It is impossible to know, of course, whether the triplet's house would have harbored such a hazard for Mary and Beeman's triplet's child. But it is reasonable to point out the proximities of time and place, given Frederick L. Wellman's and William Dykstra Miller's backgrounds. It offers a possible explanation for an otherwise odd pattern. Why were the first three autism cases a child from Forest, Mississippi, the son of a plant pathologist, and the son of a forestry professor in a southern university? The medical cluster. The second cluster that we've identified is not associated with agricultural industry exposures to mercury, but was possibly associated with mercury exposure nonetheless. This cluster is exemplified by Elizabeth Peabody. Her work on vaccination revolved around the medical world of the 1930s, especially the new effort to vaccinate every infant against diphtheria with the new diphtheria toxoid shot preserved with thimerosal or ethyl mercury. We've already traced Peabody's route from Boston to Annapolis to Johns Hopkins with her son, John, whom Kanner called Herbert B., no doubt to mask the identity of a family in the same profession. But the first family that suggested the medical connection was that of David Speck, whose mother, Miriam Partridge Speck, moved with him back to Baltimore from Washington just a few weeks after he was born, in the summer of 1932, to live with her parents. She returned to a city that was in full battle mode against diphtheria. The war had begun in 1931 with a drive to immunize the city's children by 6 months of age. This coincided with the rise of the diphtheria toxoid vaccine outlined in Chapter 5, a new treatment that was an improvement on the toxin-antitoxin formulation because it was more effective, caused fewer obvious reactions, and required only 2 shots, not 3. The use of aluminum as an adjuvant reduced that to 1 shot by the mid-1930s, a public health officer's dream. The city's residents were bombarded. In January 1932, the Commissioner of Health sent a circular to the city's private physicians that included a diphtheria inoculation certificate to be given to parents, stated the City Health Department's annual report. The same month, a 6-month greeting card program was inaugurated. The purpose of the card was to call attention to the fact that 6 months is the best age for the child to receive, from a physician, toxoid inoculations for prevention of diphtheria. The campaign was stepped up the following year. In terms of children given 2 successive doses of toxoid, the 1933 campaign was eminently successful, the health department reported. By the end of 1933, health officials estimated that 31.3% of children under 5 had received the required inoculations, up from 24.1% at the close of 1932. The 1933 campaign featured a minute-and-a-half film called A Toxoid Talkie Trailer, shown in 31 movie theaters in metropolitan Baltimore in the first half of May. Officials estimated that half the population saw the film. Did this campaign reach Miriam Speck and her infant son, David? That seems likely. When she returned to Baltimore, she began studying psychology at Hopkins, which was in the middle of its drive to vaccinate every child. Just as the campaign was getting underway, The Eastern Health District of Baltimore was established in 1932 as a joint project of the City Health Department and Johns Hopkins. It operated very much along the lines of the Well Baby Clinic at Harvard, as doctors and nurses tried to promote health and prevent infectious illness through routine screenings, better sanitation and diet, and vaccination. Many district services concentrated on child health problems, such as measles, hearing impairment, and dental health, noted Elizabeth Fee, a Hopkins professor who wrote the definitive history of the effort. The district provided prenatal clinics and well baby clinics, free smallpox vaccinations, diphtheria antitoxin, medical, dental, and eye examinations, child care instruction, doctor and hospital referrals, and a constant stream of health advice distributed to anyone who would read or listen. Fee continued that public health clinics provided 50,000 medical exams each year, roughly one per inhabitant, with a special focus on newborn children. The Baltimore Sun reported, "Every child in the district, and a good share of adults, comes, sooner or later, into the grasp of a health officer or nurse. No child can escape. Some of them are under the benevolent dictation before they are born." As with the fungicide cluster, the association between exposure and outcome rests not on one case alone, but in the way the evidence converges and overlaps. Elizabeth Peabody Trevett's work with the Well Baby Clinic and its diphtheria vaccination component at Harvard is the most direct sign of a connection to heightened risk of infant vaccination with a thimerosal-containing vaccine in the first cases. In addition, any mother employed in medicine would also have been more likely to vaccinate herself while pregnant, the way some of the early cases clustered around Baltimore and its active anti-diphtheria campaign starting in the early 1930s is also noteworthy. In 1927, Wendell Munsey completed his medical degree at Johns Hopkins. He spent 1 year at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit and another in the far more glamorous American Hospital of Paris, before settling into his psychiatric residency at the Henry Phipps Clinic at Hopkins. Although later in life he was an office psychiatrist, early in his career he clearly spent a substantial amount of time doing laboratory work. In 1929, he co-authored a paper titled Neuroepithelioma of the Cerebellum, a review of the tumors of the central nervous system that was based on the collection of brain pathology specimens at the Henry Ford Hospital. Shortly after the paper was published, he married a Hopkins nurse, Rachel Carey, in a union that brought together two medical professionals and their associated exposure risks. On October 30, 1933, they had a daughter, Bridget. Like the other children we have profiled, she had unusual problems from the beginning, suggesting a greater role for exposure during pregnancy, and soon became Case 5, Barbara Kay, in Leo Kanner's landmark paper. Kanner, no doubt, chose a pseudonym to disguise Wendell Munsey's identity from his Hopkins colleagues, and perhaps because of that close relationship, he treated the family better than he did some others in print. "Barbara's father is a prominent psychiatrist," he wrote. "Her mother is a well-educated, kindly woman." When Kanner saw Bridget Munsey in 1942, she followed the pattern with which he was by now familiar. "During the entire interview, there was no indication of any kind of affective contact," he wrote. "She could speak and knew the days of the week, but according to her father, a fine writer and trained observer, as evidenced by his psychobiology text, she was never normal. Repetitious as a baby, and obsessive now, holds things in hands, takes things to bed with her, repeats phrases, gets stuck on an idea, game, etc., and rides it hard, then goes to something else. She used to talk using you for herself and I for her mother or me, as if she were saying things as we would in talking to her. Like Donald, she also had feeding problems. She nursed poorly and quit taking any kind of nourishment at 3 months. She was tube-fed 5 times daily up to 1 year of age. She began to eat then, though there was much difficulty until she was about 18 months old. Feeding problems also plagued Case 10, John F., whose real name was Lee Reuven Rosenberg, and whose father was Seymour Rosenberg, another psychiatrist with roots nearby. Rosenberg got his M.D. from George Washington University in 1927, the same year Wendell Munsey graduated from Hopkins. He interned at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the big federal psychiatric facility in Washington, where in 1933 he published a paper on The Diathermy Treatment of Dementia Paralytica, GPI, suggesting, like Lawrence Trivet, a background in the contemporary standard of syphilis care, mercury and arsenic rubs, and injections. The Rosenbergs' first child, Lee, was born in 1937. By 1938, the father was doing research in neurophysiology at Hopkins and was an assistant dispensary physician. By 1939, he was an assistant psychiatrist. Given that neurosyphilis remained one of the chief causes of psychiatric hospitalization, and that the arrival of penicillin was still a few years away, Rosenberg certainly had an occupational risk for exposure to mercury and other toxic substances, as did Trivet and Munsey. They were first and foremost neurologists, brain doctors, and Rosenberg's wife had an even more direct link, similar to Wendell Munsey's link of brain tumor research. Ruth Roman had been a stenographer in a pathology lab at the Gallinger Municipal Hospital in Washington. In Autistic Disturbances, Kanner calls her a secretary in a pathology lab, but the more precise job description is significant. In the days before recording devices, pathologists like Munsey dictated their findings as they hovered over dead bodies and preserved tissue specimens, and stenographers, like Roman, hovered nearby to record their observations. Mercuric chloride, as we've seen, was once the medical antiseptic of choice. A related and longer use was as a fixative to preserve tissue specimens and prevent contamination. The risk of mercuric chloride exposure to pathology lab workers was very real, documented in a 1977 paper in the British Journal of Industrial Medicine. The use of mercuric chloride as an histological fixative was associated with high environmental atmospheric concentrations of mercury vapor, as well as mercury compounds. Technicians exposed to this environment showed increased urinary mercury. Contamination of histology laboratories by mercuric chloride should be minimized. If this was a problem in 1977, one can only imagine the exposures half a century earlier at Gallinger Municipal Hospital, where Ruth Roman worked, and the Henry Ford Hospital where Wendell Munsey did his research. We propose that this combination of background exposure to mercury combined with the diphtheria shot provides the simplest explanation for the medical cluster apparent in the first case series. The vaccine was probably also given to the children in the fungicide cluster. Donald Triplett's brother, O.B. Triplett III, had a specific recollection of their family receiving diphtheria shots in his childhood, and in 1939, the Millers' home state, North Carolina, became an early adopter of the vaccine and the first in the nation to require it by 1 year of age. Richard was born there in November 1937. When Seymour Rosenberg reached out to Kanner about his son Lee's problems, it was not behavior that he focused on. "The main thing that worries me is the difficulty in feeding. That is the essential thing, and secondly, his slowness in development. During the first days of life, he did not take the breast satisfactorily. After 15 days, he was changed from breast to bottle, but did not take the bottle satisfactorily. There is a long story of trying to get food down. We have tried everything under the sun." From the beginning, then, feeding and gastrointestinal issues plagued a significant number of children with autism, problems serious enough to be a major feature of the case descriptions. It is a topic that will loom larger as we bring the history of autism into the present day. In summary, in addition to the three cases of the fungicide cluster, we have traced the family backgrounds of four more of Kanner's original 11 autism cases, all of them with medical connections, sometimes in both spouses. The children of these medical professionals echo, if more weakly, the exposure themes of the children of the fungicide cluster. In all cases, there is a plausible mercury connection. In addition, there is an association in time, one we concede is speculative, with the newly emerging availability of the first thimerosal-containing vaccine. We find it noteworthy that these two completely different sources of exposure were based on ethyl mercury compounds synthesized by the same inventor. Others will have to judge for themselves. Of the remaining four children we have been unable to identify among the first 11, this much can be said. They share similar attributes. Case 4, Paul G., fits the environmental exposure model if the mother and child had occupational exposures through the father. Paul G.'s father worked as a mining engineer. Coal contains mercury. Mercury is used to extract gold and silver from ore because of its strong chemical bond. Mercury itself is mined, and its hazards are legendary, and mining makes heavy use of blasting materials that are detonated by mercury fulminate. Some background exposure to mercury in one form or another would have been almost inevitable. Case 9. Charles N., the son of a self-made clothing merchant father and a mother who was a theatrical booking agent in Manhattan, also fits. Charles was born in 1938, putting him in New York City after it had taken a leading role in adopting universal diphtheria toxoid vaccination. Case 11. Elaine C., fits too. She was born in February 1932, in what was no doubt a large city that would support her Sorbonne-educated father with a law degree and an ad copywriting background, and her mother, who had done editorial work for a magazine before marriage. Elaine had been evaluated by a psychiatrist in Boston, and as we have seen from Elizabeth Peabody, the Well Baby vaccination regimen had roots there, too. And finally, the eldest child fits. Case 6. Virginia S. Her father was a psychiatrist, too. Kanner focused on his personal qualities. He clearly loathed the man. Perhaps he knew him, or the fact that his daughter had by then been dumped in an institution for half her life offended him. "I have never liked children," he quotes the father saying, probably a reaction on my part to the restraint from movement, travel, the minor interruptions and commotions. Of Virginia's mother, her husband said, "She is not by any means the mother type. Her attitude toward a child is more like toward a doll or pet than anything." Whatever the case, it is also true that Virginia was born just in time to be caught up in the early wave of diphtheria vaccination in Baltimore or New York or Boston, or another early adopter location. We continue to search for this eldest child of the age of autism, and whatever clues her identity may hold. I object. Not surprisingly, autistic disturbances of affective contact attracted immediate attention in the profession. J. Louise Despert, another leading child psychiatrist, and in marked contrast to Kanner, a committed Freudian, wrote him from New York City not long after its appearance. "I take this opportunity to tell you how interested I was in your article, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact, which appeared in The Nervous Child for 1943. In that article you certainly have clearly and concisely defined a clinical entity which had baffled many observers." That was faint praise, given Kanner's claim that the disorder was previously unknown to him or anyone else. Despert added more faint praise, conceding that his work will do much to bring order and clarity in the confused mass of mental illnesses of the earliest years. But she couched her true opinion in the praise she withheld, commenting, Whether or not the similarities with the previously described schizophrenia in childhood should be later established is an issue to be resolved after further study. Despert resolved that issue quickly in her own mind. On July 12th, just 3 months after autistic disturbances appeared, she wrote Kanner, "It seems to me the greatest contribution this article is making is in its thorough, accurate, and illuminating description of clinical cases. However, if you will permit me to say so, I object to the coining of new terminology for entities which, while perhaps not so carefully described, have been previously reported." She cited accounts by herself and others of early childhood schizophrenia with insidious onset, the symptomatology of which is in all respects similar to the entity you describe. Even you in your textbook have given a general definition of schizophrenia, withdrawal from the environmental realities, etc., which does not necessarily imply an initial normal development. Kanner, confident in the originality of his observations, replied with artful courtesy, "I thank you very much for your very thoughtful and very helpful letter, and I want you to know that, in principle, I am in full agreement with its contents." He wrote back 3 days later, suggesting an eagerness to knock down this potentially serious objection without making an enemy of a powerful peer. "I also want you to know that I am thoroughly familiar with your own work, which, in my opinion and that of many others, represents a genuine contribution to our knowledge of schizophrenia." And he noted, "I have, as is inevitable, seen typical schizophrenic children at a very early age." Kanner was familiar with childhood schizophrenia, having described it in detail in his textbook, Child Psychiatry. The vast majority of these cases experienced regression in childhood, the period between 3 years of age and puberty. In his letter to Despert, he outlined the difference between autism and the previous medical literature on mentally ill children that Despert claimed as antecedents. The 11 children in autistic disturbances, he said, singled themselves out by their very distinctive phenomenology. "What strikes me in the group which I have discussed in my paper is the apparent disability from the beginning of life to form adequate affective contact rather than withdrawal from adequate or near-adequate contact already established. This is the essential thing which, in my mind, sets the group off from other infantile schizophrenics of my acquaintance or those reported in the literature." Kanner's focus on this point, "These children were born this way," was evident throughout his paper, which he closed by describing the 11 children, rather antiseptically, as pure culture examples of inborn autistic disturbances of affective contact. Emphasis in original. Autism, at that time, had a precise meaning in psychiatry, defined in the 1934 edition of Webster's New International Dictionary as absorption in fantasy to the exclusion of interest in external reality. Autos is Greek for self, as in autobiography, so it was not autism, isolation from external reality, as an element of childhood mental illness that Kanner claimed as his discovery. That would be like a contemporary physicist breathlessly announcing that hydrogen was an element of water. It was the absence of emotional connection from the very beginning of life, an absence so complete it was autistic. That was new. First of all, he wrote in the paper, "Even in cases with the earliest recorded onset of schizophrenia, the first observable manifestations were preceded by at least 2 years of essentially average development. The histories specifically emphasize a more or less gradual change in the patient's behavior. The children of our group have all shown their extreme aloneness from the beginning of life, not responding to anything that comes to them from the outside world." Of course, autism has long since come to stand for the specific disorder Kanner identified. He himself soon began to call it early infantile autism, continuing to emphasize through repetition early and infantile, its appearance from the beginning of life. In recent years, a subset called regressive autism has emerged, with onset usually apparent between the first and second birthdays after a period of normal development. But this is still infantile autism, and also distinct from the well-recognized phenomenon of childhood schizophrenia that both Despert and Kanner discussed. Strictly speaking, the transition from infancy to childhood as a developmental phase does not take place till about age 3, when the toddler begins walking and talking and is fully weaned from his mother. Autism is not ancient. Childhood schizophrenia was well established as a diagnostic category long before Despert wrote Kanner about it. In 1938, the same year Donald T. arrived at Johns Hopkins from Forest, Mississippi, a researcher named R. A. Q. Lay at Guy's Hospital in London published a thorough review in a 28-page paper titled Schizophrenia-like Psychoses in Young Children. Such a survey would be expected to capture any case descriptions matching Kanner's striking syndrome, but none had the unique cluster of behaviors Kanner laid out in such meticulous detail. Let's pause for emphasis here. Because the lack of comparable cases in this contemporaneous survey of medical literature is a powerful counter to glib assertions that autism is ancient, that surely autistic disorder like mental retardation has been one of man's medical maladies from earliest times, that the history of autistic disorders stretches far back into the mists of time, that the cluster of symptoms we now know as autism has probably been around for a long time, but no one really knows for sure. Severe mental illness of any kind was quite rare in children, Lay concluded. Strecker, 1921, was able to find 18 cases of psychosis in children among 5,000 admissions to mental hospitals. Of these, 4 were dementia praecox, 10 manic depressive, and 4 of doubtful type. All, however, were over 10 years of age. The few early onset cases Lay does describe are not easy to confuse with autism. In a discussion of manic illnesses in children, he notes, Bloiler stated that in 5% of his cases, the subjects could be shown to have been predisposed from the very beginning. And in cases with arguably autistic features, the onset is obviously later. Lay cites 2 researchers, Wilhelm Wegend and Theodor Heller, who described children in the early 1900s in Vienna and Germany with what was called dementia infantilis. After a period of normal development, during the 3rd or 4th year of life, there appeared, in the cases he described, a change of behavior involving a marked degree of motor restlessness. These symptoms were always accompanied by serious disturbances of speech, leading eventually to its almost complete loss, and the whole process ending in complete dementia within a few months. Wegend drew attention especially to the intelligent facial expression of the patient, and to the absence of any neurological lesion or convulsions. The Wegend and Heller cases would most likely be diagnosed today with childhood disintegrative disorder under the grouping of pervasive developmental disorders described in the U.S. Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. The rate is vanishingly low, as infrequent as 1 in 90,000 children. Kanner was well aware of them by the time he wrote Autistic Disturbances, and he later noted that Heller's cases were behaviorally similar to his, but with later onset. So neither Leo Kanner's own exhaustive 1935 childhood psychiatry textbook nor Lay's contemporaneous review of medical literature offered any indication that autism was ancient. Many capable observers over a long period of time had observed, recorded, and published papers on unusual behaviors in children and had not found anything of the kind. Excluding Down's analysis, which includes no case descriptions, we are left with a handful of scattered cases on which the entire argument against the novelty of Kanner's discovery rests. Each of these deserves detailed attention. Kanner himself cited one pre-1930 child as autistic, a girl named Jane, described in Case Report, 28 Years After an Infantile Autistic Disorder, by George C. Darr and Frederick G. Warden. In 1921, a 4-year-old girl was brought to the Henry Phipps Psychiatric Clinic of the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Kanner wrote in a preface to this republication of the case, "From the descriptions by Dr. Adolf Meyer and Dr. Esther Richards, who saw her, it is apparent that the child presented a syndrome now called early infantile autism." Meyer, of course, was Kanner's mentor, and Richards was a colleague. While certain features of the case are consistent with autism, the child does not look into people's eyes. Nothing makes a great deal of difference. She is not much affected by stimuli, is afraid of certain objects, for example, the stove. Other aspects are not. As a teenager, she had to be admitted to the disturbed ward of a mental hospital because of confused episodes, periods of excitement, threatening to jump out of the windows, feeling that she was being poisoned, that she was full of gas, and that there was no oxygen in her blood. She explained at length in fairly friendly fashion that she had chemical poisons within her and that if she lit a match, she would explode. Delusions or any description of inner life are simply not characteristic of children with autism. An alternative explanation, perhaps she was poisoned. One scenario is this was a case of acrodynia. There is detailed discussion in Meyer and Richards' case report of teething. The first tooth erupted at 6 months. The second year molars had not come in. Teething powders might well have been tried in her hometown of Philadelphia in the second decade of the century. We suspect there may have been another reason for Kanner's embrace of this single case, a nod to his mentor and his colleague. No wonder that psychiatrists of the caliber of Drs. Meyer and Richards felt that they were dealing with something unique, with something they had not encountered before, and for which they had no frame of diagnostic reference. Kanner wrote, "Even accepting the notion that Jane was a classically autistic child, Kanner's comment shows his continued emphasis on how rare and identifiable it was. Kanner never focused on this case again. It's possible that, as the children in his own original case series began to grow into adulthood, he realized they bore little resemblance to Jane, the 30-year-old adult." Another case that is sometimes cited might also be acrodynia. It was titled Dawn, a curable case of arrested development due to a fear psychosis, the result of a shock in a 3-year-old infant, by Leitner Wittmer, a Philadelphia psychologist. "I saw Donald for the first time when he was 2 years and 7 months old, in 1919, wrote Wittmer. His father carried him into the office and deposited him, a soulless lump, upon the couch. He sat there with the stolidity of a Buddhist image, absorbed in the inspection of a card he held in his pudgy hands, as regardless of his father and mother as of the new objects around him. His overall physical development was profoundly delayed," Wittmer recounted. "As the flower blooms, the fish swims or the bird flies, so the child crawls, walks, and talks. It is the unfolding of his own instinctive impulses. But this child had to be taught to crawl and to walk, and even then he could only toddle around uncertainly. He never uttered a word spontaneously. These could well be autistic features. They might also be neurological signs we have seen described in acrodynia, mutism, the loss of the usual gay and happy disposition, the failure to display any affection that Rocas described in such children. It could also have been a post-encephalitic condition. He had an illness after birth," Wittmer wrote of Don, "which I now believe left his brain so devitalized that it permitted fear to gain the upper hand over desire." 3 more cases with plausibly autistic features were described in a retrospective analysis of case histories taken from the notes of Dr. William Howship Dickinson at London's Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children between 1869 and 1882. The authors, Mitzi Waltz and Paul Shattuck, examined 398 cases before identifying 3 that fit the criteria. These again could implicate some combination of the environmental factors we have already pointed to as raising the risk for autism, from the coal-saturated London atmosphere to the widespread use of teething powders. In fact, the authors mention the latter. It should be noted that mercury chloride, Mercuris, came into popular use as a patent medicine sedative for teething babies in the later years of the 19th century, and was revealed several decades later to cause widespread developmental and physical health problems, including the condition known as pink disease. But since these three are among the strongest of the plausibly pre-Kanner autism cases, let's treat them as evidence. It is worth noting a common feature. Many of the children with autistic symptoms described by Dickinson also presented with serious bowel disturbances. In one of the three cases described in this article, senna syrup, calomel, mercury chloride, and cod liver oil were used to address the issue with some success. Going farther back, among the first to cite childhood mental illness was John Haslam at Bethlehem Asylum. The same observer who gave one of the earliest descriptors of general paralysis of the insane among adults. As we described previously, one case in particular stands out. This child developed normally until she was 2 years of age, when she had an adverse reaction to Jenner's new smallpox vaccine. From the termination of the smallpox to the above date, 9 months, the child continued in an insane state. About the same time as Haslam was writing, a new phenomenon emerged, the so-called feral child. A classic case was Caspar Hauser, who had smallpox inoculation scars on both arms, usually a sign of high birth. Another was Victor, the so-called wild boy of Aveyron. These cases captured widespread popular attention, illustrating, if nothing else, their extreme rarity. The idea that such feral children were really autistic was first promulgated by Bruno Bettelheim, a 20th-century Austrian transplant to Chicago. Bettelheim had become the leading advocate of the theory that neglectful parents, and especially mothers, were responsible for their child's autism. As Nicole Simon writes, Bettelheim, 1959, proposed that the non-human behavior of children like Victor is the result of parental neglect suffered long before abandonment in the wild. He based this notion on his observations of autistic children and his conclusion that autism results from emotional rejection of the child by his parents. The argument that feral children were actually early cases of autism is now accepted by many in the medical profession and given as evidence of its constant prevalence through human history. In his 1979 book, The Wild Boy of Aveyron, Harlan Lane notes that several contemporary authorities on child psychiatry have proposed that Victor suffered originally not from mental retardation, but from a personality disorder unidentified then, childhood psychosis, or autism. But Lane argues that the similarities between Victor and autistic children seem to be exaggerated. It is simply impossible to describe Victor as profoundly withdrawn from people. Many passages testify to his affection toward those who were kind to him, his desire to please, his sensitivity to reproach. And to the extent that he did have autistic characteristics, what is there about Victor's deviant behavior in society that cannot be explained by his adaptive behavior in the forest? Furthermore, if he had been autistic when his parents abandoned him at age 5, could he even have begun to survive in the woods? Whatever the case, these children were so rare and such intense objects of fascination as to argue against the idea that autism was already common during their times. They recall Leo Kanner's identification of Thomas Robertson, the Native American with general paralysis of the insane, which he said highlighted the fact such a case is so rare that it is really regarded as a curiosity. A recent survey of the wild child phenomenon points to an early mention by Charles Linnaeus of just 9 wild men over a period of several centuries. Autism, then, appeared to be what Leo Kanner said it was, a new disorder that differed strongly from those already described, rather than one that Kanner's discerning clinical eye finally managed to spot. The implications are enormous, because if autism was a new disorder, that argues for a largely environmental rather than a genetic cause. In sum, both common sense and a careful review of case histories suggest that Leo Kanner meant what he said, and that what he said was right. Autism was different. Bernard Rimland, a researcher and autism parent whom we will introduce in the next chapter, noted that Kanner earned his M.D. in 1919 in Berlin, came to Hopkins in 1928, and has been reported to have seen well over 20,000 children in the course of his psychiatric career. It is remarkable, in retrospect, that none of the autistic children were seen in Kanner's first 12 years of practice, and all 11 were born after 1930. It is also remarkable that a similar cluster of children appeared on another continent at the same time. Vienna, again. In 1943, the same year Leo Kanner's landmark paper was published, an Austrian pediatrician, Hans Asperger, finished a study that centered on a case series of 4 boys and submitted it to a medical journal. It was titled Autistic Psychopathy in Childhood, and published in 1944 at the height of World War II. There was no contact between Kanner and Asperger before its publication, and, based on a thorough review of Kanner's archives, no evidence of communication afterward. The aim of this paper was to report on a personality disorder already manifest in childhood, which to my knowledge has not yet been described. Asperger wrote, echoing Kanner's comment about a fundamentally different disorder. In what follows, I will describe a particularly interesting and highly recognizable type of child. The children I will present all have in common a fundamental disturbance which manifests itself in their physical appearance, expressive functions, and indeed, their whole behavior. This disturbance results in severe and characteristic difficulties of social integration. In other words, they displayed, as their central feature, autistic disturbances of affective contact, and although they were higher functioning than the majority of Kanner's cases, because they had functional speech, in many ways they were clearly a mirror image, from across the Atlantic, of the same striking, highly recognizable childhood disorder. Asperger's case series was smaller than Kanner's, a sufficient number for him to believe in a pattern, but he provided nowhere near the background information that Kanner did. Still, he started in a similar fashion with Fritz V., who was born in June 1933, a mere 3 months before Donald Triplett, and first seen in autumn 1939, a year after Donald's arrival at Hopkins. We start with a highly unusual boy who shows a very severe impairment in social integration. He was referred by his school as he was considered to be unteachable by the end of the first day there. Fritz was the first child of his parents. Motor milestones were rather delayed. He learnt to walk at 14 months, and for a long time was extremely clumsy and unable to do things for himself. In contrast, he learnt to talk very early and spoke his first words at 10 months, well before he could walk. He quickly learnt to express himself in sentences and soon talked like an adult. From the earliest age, Fritz never did what he was told. He did just what he wanted to, or the opposite of what he was told. He was never able to become integrated into a group of playing children. He never got on with other children, and in fact, was not interested in them. He had no real love for anybody, but occasionally had fits of affection. Another strange phenomenon in this boy was the occurrence of certain stereotypic movements and habits. So it went through the next 3 cases, Harrow L., Ernst K., and Helmut L. All were born in the 1930s, except Harrow, who was born in the mid-1920s and had severe asphyxia at birth and was resuscitated at length. Soon after his birth, he had convulsions. He, too, was delayed physically, starting to walk and talk only at the end of his second year. However, he then learnt to speak relatively quickly, and even as a toddler, he talked like a grown-up. He was also grotesquely fat, and, unlike the other Asperger and Kanner cases, his appearance was grotesque. On top of the massive body over the big face with flabby cheeks was a tiny skull. One could almost consider him microcephalic. In retrospect, Harrow appears to be an outlier in this group, which would make Asperger's true case series really three. The mothers and fathers were more of a mixed lot than Kanner's well-educated and mostly well-to-do parents. Fritz's mother came from the family of one of Austria's greatest poets, the father from an ordinary farming family. Harrow's father was a painter and sculptor, but out of financial necessity he was making brooms and brushes. He came from peasant stock, but was a typical intellectual. Ernst's father was a tailor's assistant, and his mother a very bright and extremely nice woman whose life was not easy, nervous, and prone to headaches. Helmut's parents were described only as without any peculiarities, in contrast to their grotesque-looking child. In discussing the clinical picture of autistic psychopathy, Asperger noted, "The autistic personality is highly distinctive, despite wide differences. From the second year of life, we find already the characteristic features which remain unmistakable and constant throughout the whole lifespan." About Fritz, Asperger provides this haunting description. His gaze was strikingly odd. It was generally directed into the void. Most discussions of the timing and similarities of Asperger's and Kanner's reports treat them as a remarkable coincidence. We find that remarkable. Child psychiatry was emerging on both continents simultaneously, writes anthropologist Roy Richard Grinker in On Strange Minds. And he proposes that, today, most mental health professionals think that Kanner and Asperger were treating different kinds of patients. The idea fits neatly with Grinker's belief that autism is a constant prevalence genetic disorder that merely escaped the attention of everyone before it was observed by not one but two clinicians, on two continents, in papers submitted for publication the same year. But there is another possibility. Starting about 1930, the ethyl mercury seed treatment, Saracen, was jointly marketed by DuPont in the United States and Bayer in Europe under a partnership called DuBay. The diphtheria toxoid was also introduced in Austria in the 1930s, but with an intriguing difference. It was generally administered after the age of two and primarily targeted at school children. In the United States, the recommended age was much earlier. 6 months is the best age, the Baltimore City Health Department reported in 1932. It was routinely administered at 9 months in Boston's Harvard School of Public Health Well Baby Clinic. Could the later exposure to the diphtheria shot in Austria have allowed Asperger's children to acquire functional language, the main distinction between the two syndromes? Gold salts. Although Leo Kanner fought off the Freudians as he built his reputation as a child psychiatrist, even ridiculed their founder and his ideas, he was not immune to the possibility that parents were complicit in autism. His 1943 paper contains this penultimate paragraph. One other fact stands out prominently. In the whole group, there are very few really warm-hearted fathers and mothers. They are limited in genuine interest in people. Even some of the happiest marriages are rather formal affairs. Three of the marriages were dismal failures. The question arises whether or to what extent this fact has contributed to the condition of the children. In keeping with this vague concern, Canner suggested that Beeman and Mary Triplett send Donald to live on a farm with a simple, warm-hearted couple, as Canner called them. One of us went to Forest, Mississippi in 2005 and met with Donald's brother, O.B., who described an unknown aspect of this story. When Donald was nearly 14, he became quite ill, and the farm family that he had been sent to live with, the Lewises, brought him back to the Triplets. By then he had a high fever, his joints were severely swollen, and he'd stopped eating. As they had done when his behavioral problems surfaced a decade earlier, the Triplets looked far and wide for help, even taking him to the famed Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. But no one could figure out the problem, and his health continued its sharp decline. As his father told a doctor and family friend he encountered in nearby Raleigh, Mississippi, "It looks like Don's getting ready to die." That doctor proved a lifesaver when he suggested the child might have a very rare condition called juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, JRA, also known as Still's disease, named after the London physician George Still we mentioned in Chapter 4, who also first described ADHD. They immediately took Donald to the Campbell Clinic in Memphis, which specialized in orthopedic problems like arthritis, and he underwent a series of treatments with gold salts that lasted several months. Gold salts were then the standard remedy for JRA. They are still FDA approved, but newer treatments with fewer side effects are now the standard of care. In Donald's case, the results were astounding. His arthritis cleared up, leaving behind the minor reminder of one fused knuckle. But something even more remarkable happened. As the treatment came to its end, the nervousness and extreme anxiety that had heretofore afflicted him all but disappeared. His brother recounted in courtly fashion. He became more social. The defining features of his disability lessened dramatically and permanently. "It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. He just had a miraculous response to the medicine." In the medical world, Donald's recovery, in association with the gold salts treatment, barely registered and was quickly forgotten. Leon Eisenberg, a Hopkins colleague of Canner's, wrote in 1956, "Donald, at 14, developed an undiagnosed illness manifested by fever, chills, and joint pains. He became bedridden and developed joint contractures." On the basis of a tentative diagnosis of Still's disease, he was placed empirically on gold therapy with marked improvement. After 18 months, he was once again ambulatory. He emerged with little residual deficit from a second episode of arthritis 2 years later. The clinical improvement in his behavior, first observed during his rural placement, was accelerated during and after his illness and convalescence at home. In a 1971 follow-up, Canner mentioned the arthritis attacks, but not the gold salts treatment, focusing instead on the intuitive wisdom of the farm couple that so clearly contrasted with the very few really warm-hearted fathers and mothers of the 11 children. In fact, Eisenberg's reference seems to be the sole published mention of the treatment. Thus, did the very first child with autism stage a recovery that his family attributed to a biomedical intervention? The leading experts in autism missed this entirely. When Leo Canner looked back on his discovery of autism, he linked it to his admittedly superstitious belief in serendipity. Noting in 1979 that there were 102 chapters of the National Society for Autistic Children in the United States, and 66 more in 31 countries around the world, he marveled. All this started 40 years ago with Donald T., the first reported specimen of what many of my colleagues call the Canner syndrome. How is that for serendipity? But the head of a prominent clinic and author of the Standard Diagnostic Manual cannot claim to be endowed with serendipity or the gift of finding unsought treasures, simply because the first reported specimen of a new childhood psychiatric disorder is referred to him. True serendipity would have required a greater degree of sagacity, deducing the reason these first cases suddenly appeared, the real treasure buried in the shared backgrounds of those 11 children's families. For Leo Kanner, that was not to be, and not for the first time. 2 decades earlier in South Dakota, he identified the rarity of general paralysis of the insane among Indians with syphilis. The observation was correct, but he missed the clue hidden in plain sight. Indians did not treat syphilis with mercury, and he fell into groundless speculation. The relative absence of general paralysis among the Indians can be explained by the old age of syphilis in the race. When autism arrived a decade later on his doorstep in Baltimore, he identified the disorder but overlooked the same clue: mercury exposure. And once more, he wandered onto shaky ground. His suspicions about parents, which would grow from an afterthought into a malignant theory, was all the more unfortunate given his contempt for Freudian parent bashing. In The Travels and Adventures of Serendipity, a marvelous book on the history of the word in the English language and its role in medical discovery, scientific sociologist Robert King Merton and Eleanor G. Barber quote an essay by David Siegel titled Chance and the Prepared Mind. Many of the great advances in medical science have come by simple means, and often by chance. Emphasis in original. It would seem as if Providence were exercising wit and playfulness in hiding the missing piece of the scientific puzzle behind a nearby elm tree, while the search went on in a distant and exotic forest. But the rewarding chance observation may be missed, even when the investigator finds the elm tree, unless he has a sound training in his chosen field. He may lack the receptors characteristic of the trained mind to take advantage of the chance observation. Where observation is concerned, chance favors only the prepared mind, Pasteur said. Leo Kanner's mind was prepared only to identify cases rather than causes. The missing autism puzzle piece, strong evidence of a role for environmental exposure, including mercury, has remained hidden almost literally behind a nearby tree while the search wandered through ever more distant and exotic forests. That is not serendipity. That is tragedy.